If all of this is true, and the evidence strongly suggests that it is, then our government, for some reason, has taken the stance that the general public must not be told the truth.
A lot of people are wondering if NASA is really telling us the truth. We've all seen those pieces of video from NASA that seems to show other things out there besides our astronauts and our space station.
Too many questions and not enough answers.
Jeff Challender is with us, and Jeff has made a life of watching NASA TV. He records everything, and I think you'll find what he has to say and present here very, very interesting, to say the least. Jeff, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine.
We've been in touch, as they say, our people with your people. And you do a lot of video, and we're going to get into that here in a little bit. But basically, it's a radio show, and you wondered how we could do a lot of these things. But so you brought some audio clips this time.
Yes, I did. Some very interesting items.
First, before we get into that, let's tell everyone a little bit about your website and why you're doing this and what you're doing.
Okay, well, my website is www.projectprove.com.
And, of course, we have a link to it. And, in fact, we have a place where we actually go over to your website on our website with a iframe.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but we wanted the listeners to know, because that's full of a lot of information over there. I mean, you really got... What? Tell me a little bit. You're kind of just a guy that checks all of the signals coming from everywhere. Is that the deal?
Okay. Well, essentially, I record entire shuttle flights from NASA Select Television, which is a public broadcast.
Right.
Anyone can receive this. I record the entire mission, again, liftoff to landing, and that's approximately 330 hours of VHS tape. Then I go back through it bit by bit, word by word, looking for those nuggets of something that doesn't fit. It's unexplained. There's nothing I can come up with in my 50 years experience watching NASA that would explain these items.
And usually, when you call attention to this, NASA comes up with some strange excuse, right?
When they
acknowledge
it. I don't contact them anymore.
Yeah, well, but they
back
might hear
about
it.
Back in the 90s, I tried contacting
and
them.
And they didn't want to hear about it.
No. Sending email to a black hole. No response whatsoever.
Now, what's the first thing that you noticed? Why did you decide to do this? You had a hunch that there was more going on? Or?
Oh, no. It all started out with my basic love for space exploration.
Okay.
I've been watching our space program since 1957, when my parents got very excited over the launch of Sputnik. I didn't understand the ramifications there, but I've watched ever since. And about 10 years ago, I got an injury to my back, causing a situation where I can't...
Yeah, you're wheelchair-bound now.
Yes,
so
I had the time. I started recording NASA flights simply to make my own little documentaries of the flight for my own enjoyment, when back in 1999, I ran across something that just knocked my socks off.
And what was that?
That was what I call the flyby. It was from STS-96. A large oval-shaped object was pulsating, and it flew right past the camera on the shuttle as they were still docked to the space station. And it was at local midnight over the central Pacific Ocean. There was no sunshine, and this thing was extremely bright. And just moments later, a genuine piece of ice or debris went in front of the camera, and the comparison was like night and day.
Couldn't say that was ice chips or something.
Right, because we have the real thing going by as just moments after this anomaly.
Now, did the astronauts at the time acknowledge that they'd seen something like that?
No, they almost never do.
Mm-hmm.
There, I have some audio clips where the astronauts are talking about such things.
Well, let's listen to a couple of those here. What would you suggest that we listen to first?
Well, how about we start with the one I call "Hey Scott"?
Okay.
It's from STS-100, April 2001. Astronaut Scott Peresinski and a Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield were on an EVA or a spacewalk,
right?
Installing the new robotic arm.
Now, what should we be listening for here?
We're going to listen for Chris Hadfield to call out over his suit radio, "Hey, Scott, look at this."
Okay.
And Karaczynski says, well, I got to turn around and get myself oriented. And as he does, and he turns around, he says, wow. And then there's a 7-second pause, and he says, whoa, that was interesting. Thank you. And then he says, okay, Jeff, we're ready to move, talking to the man operating the robot arm from inside. Then moments later, it was almost as if someone says, you've got to explain what you were up on or on about. So he turns around and says later, oh, man, we were watching the sunrise. But these guys see
kind of like an afterthought.
Sunrises a day from space. And these spacewalks are planned down to the second. They don't have time for sightseeing, especially something as mundane as sunrise. So I think your viewers would enjoy listening to this audio.
Yeah, let's listen to it right now.
Hey, Scott, look this way.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay? This is Chris. I've got to do a four-man four lead. Wow. Good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Jeff, ready to maneuver again.
Okay, here you go.
Look at that in the distance.
Wow.
Beautiful. Sunrise. Hey, Philip, you ready for us to move then?
Jeff, it sounds to me like they heard something. Or saw something.
I think they did.
We heard something. We heard them see something.
Yeah. And I think the moments later, they tried a little damage control in case anyone in the public had caught that and goes, what are they talking about? Because, you know, at the time, he says, wow. He didn't say, that's a neat sunrise. He just said, after a 7-second pause, that was weird, thank you, or that was neat, something like that.
Now, Jeff, you watch your NASA TV, you tape it all, you look at it all the time. Anything besides a light ever show up? I mean, is it close enough that you can see anything? It's basically just lights slipping by that you find?
Not always.
You got something pretty incredible?
There have been several that were very incredible.
Okay, can you give me an example?
Okay, again, from STS-107, Columbia, the one that didn't make it home, unfortunately. There was an incident over the land of Australia. The shuttle was flying belly to the stars, cameras pointing straight down, and we could see Australian cities passing by in the night. Again, it was near local midnight, no sunshine anywhere, when a huge black object with an arc that went clear across the screen, extended out, would have been hundreds and hundreds of meters in diameter, comes into the field of view, blots out the cities and towns below, and then immediately the man running the camera, the INCO, who runs it from remote control in Houston, turns the camera away like, uh-oh, we can't let the people see that.
And what do you think happens? They you know, you block something out. That's done in television, commercial TV all the time. Is there a camera still recording that for NASA? Do we see their feed? In other words,
we see what they want us to see.
Okay.
There's a man in Houston known as the INCO, Instrument Communication Officer.
Okay.
He is the last word on what goes out to the public. Shuttle sports 6 different video cameras that are remote controlled by this man. So he has 6 feeds at any given time.
Well, yeah, what I was getting at, the other 5 cameras, they shut this one off or go to another camera, get away from it. They're still recording those camera feeds.
Yes.
So NASA knows what's going on.
Right. Now, there's a back room of people who work for the INCO. There's his employees or his team. And they each one monitor the feed from each of these other cameras, all 6, you know, and he chooses
And he picks a master signal to put on NASA TV.
Some years ago, one of the men who works back there contacted me discreetly.
Oh, really?
And he told me that they see anomalies all the time, but they're not permitted to talk about them. He told me that there's a core of an underground core of NASA employees who would like to see the cover-up discontinued. This man was subsequently threatened with job loss, blacklisting.
They found out he was talking to you or what?
He cared about his children.
Yeah.
Or if he didn't stop talking to me. And he was talking to me from his home computer on his time. And yet they knew.
So they're monitoring everybody probably that works in that program.
Well, at least their own employees.
Mm-hmm. And that's amazing. Now we have another audio clip here. What would you suggest this is?
This is what I call the McCool sighting. This is pilot Willie McCool of STS-107, Columbia.
It seems like that ship saw a lot. Columbia?
No, these two events were very impressive.
And then was this the same flight where it blew up?
Yes. Again, unfortunately,
I don't guess there was any kind of connection or anything, but it's kind of strange.
We couldn't assume that.
No. But it's just amazing that that these things happened on that particular flight.
Actually, it wasn't as, what would you call it, productive as some flights. There were some that just, I mean, it was
okay,
like
I wanted to get that across to the audience, because a lot of our audience are conspiracy-minded, and they might think something's going on.
So well, there are some flights where I don't find anything anomalous, not at all. And so it's just it's a roll of the dice. You never know what you're going to find on any particular mission.
So you're literally looking for the needle in the haystack and spending hours doing it and probably rewinding and checking it out.
Oh, yeah.
Again.
It takes months to analyze the data from any particular mission.
What about
the
second event here?
Okay, this is a sighting by pilot Willie McCool. He reports to the ground that he sees a bright object following with them. And then he states this is not just a long-distance satellite. And he asks if it might be the space station. Well, ground control says, well, we'll check on that. They go, come back a moment later and say, well, it's the space station. Or we have on the map, and it's tracking right along with you. And pretty much that was the end of it. The NASA commentator went from there, and over the next hour and a half made it clear that NASA was saying that Willie McCool radioed down that he saw the space station, which was going at a right angle, 1,600 miles away from the shuttle. Now, McCool stated that this object was following them. He was a combat fighter pilot. He had been an aviator in the Navy, landing on carriers, fighting his plane against Iraq. This guy knows the difference between something following and something crossing his tail.
Go ahead, Willie.
A real odd question to ask, Linda, but would it be possible to see space station from our given attitude? We see a bright object that seems to be moving with us. That's a long distance, by the way, Linda.
Okay, Willie, we'll double check that. We'll get back to you. Hey, Willie, we just had that ground track added up here to our screen, and the station's very close to you guys right now, tracking right along with you as you go towards sundown, so that could be it.
Willie McCool, pilot of Endeavour, was saying he saw a bright object.
Dave, we copy.
And ask Shuttle Capcom Linda.
One more comment for Willie and sighting of, potentially sighting the ISS. If that's what it is, it should be moving north relative to you.
This discussion about possible sighting by Columbia pilot Willie McCool of the International Space Station. Shuttle Capcom Linda Godwin telling McCool that indeed the station is also over Australia. Stations at a somewhat higher altitude than Columbia. Stations at about 240 statute miles above the Earth, and it's moving over central Australia now on a northeasterly heading. Columbia is just moving down the Australian coast, the Australian east coast, about Townsville by now, headed southeast, and its altitude's about 180 statute miles.
Columbia, Houston, don't know if you can see it on this path, but we show you're fairly close to the station again. If you look out the overhead window, kind of toward the starboard side, you might get a glimpse.
We're looking. Thanks for the heads up, Linda.
Shuttle Capcom Linda Godwin giving Columbia crew members a heads up that they might be able to see the station. Columbia's in shadow, in darkness, moving down across the eastern coast of Australia, not far from the Sydney area, while the International Space Station is on a northeasterly heading off the northwestern coast of Australia. The station's about 242 statute miles in altitude, while Columbia's altitude is about 182 statute miles. One orbit ago, about 2:50 a.m., McCool radioed down saying he saw what he believed to be the International Space Station. That was a similar sighting, except the two spacecraft were a bit closer together than they are now. Columbia was just off the northeast coast of Australia, while the station was moving over the central part of that island continent. As in this pass, the station at its higher altitude was in sunlight, while Columbia was in the Earth's shadow in darkness. Both the International Space Station flight control room and the shuttle flight control room believe that that was in fact a sighting on the last pass, but we've heard nothing from the Columbia crew members about whether they believe they can see the station this time around.
When we talk about why NASA does this, and it's pretty obvious that they don't want people talking, what are they trying to hide? Do you have any idea? Just the idea that they're out there and they can't explain it? Or is it to go deeper than that, or what?
I don't have that data. The pattern suggests that they know what these are, or at least they know that they are there, and they don't want us and the public to see them. Now, they do, like I told you, in the back room, from the six different cameras, they record all of it. But we only get to see a portion of what they want us to see. Occasionally, one of these things gets past the sensors, and that's where I am looking for them.
When we talk about some of the things that you've seen over the years, what was the first flight that you monitored? Was it the first one they did? Or?
Well, I've been watching since 1958. I watched the very first shuttle flight. I've kept my eye on things. But I first started recording in the summer of 1997, STS-86. I was drawn to start recording.
So you're coming up on 10 years.
Right. Almost 10 years.
And why now? You were getting ready to say because?
Because I was very drawn to record these because of the emergency situations aboard Space Station Mir that summer. There was a collision. An entire module's air supply was compromised. People almost died. It was very riveting, and I decided to record these events for my own record, not that I was looking for UFOs at that point.
You were basically just thought that you would make a good documentary for yourself, and
for
these
my
things
own
happen, right?
I wasn't intending to sell this or produce movies. Just
now when you had. You were interested in space travel, naturally, so probably UFOs were kind of interest to you, but probably, I don't know, were you really a UFO guy at all?
I started reading everything I could lay my hands on about UFOs at the age of 12,
okay,
back in the mid-60s.
We're going to be right back, so don't go away.
The American Southwest, a land of abandoned stagecoach stops, crumbling ghost towns, obscure, overgrown wagon trails, all ghosts of an exciting and romantic past. But amidst the hogback ridges and desolate expanses of the Four Corners region, stories float about of secrets, whispers of extraterrestrial spacecraft, intruding galactic visitors from other worlds, underground facilities, and above top secret recovery operations. Come now on a journey through this prehistoric land as we visit several locations where some of the most guarded secrets of the modern age have alleged to unfold. Along the way, we will speak with some of the most respected investigators, reporters, authors, and lecturers in the field of UFO research.
Fallen Angels, the DVD that shows the mysteries that haunt the desert Southwest. Order Fallen Angels today from ShopCherryPippin.com.
You've got some other examples, audio clips. Let's get into here. What do you have for us, Jeff?
Okay, well, here's a double one. They're several months apart, but I think what I stumbled upon here is the Russian code word for UFO among cosmonauts. Similar to back in the 60s, it's been rumored a long time that the astronaut code word was Santa Claus.
Okay.
I'm sure many of your viewers have heard of that.
Right.
But in this case, we have a cosmonaut. His name was Sasha Kaleri on International Space Station Expedition Flight 8. And they were on EVA outside, he and his commander, Michael Full, an American astronaut. And at one point, right out of the blue, after we had seen four different anomalies appear on camera from this EVA, Kaleri says, "So dinosaurs are needed here. Can't do anything without them." And Moscow says, "Say it again? like they were, what is he talking about? And he says, the dinosaurs, I have them here, they're with me now. And they said, okay, we get it, let them be with you. He says, understood, and never said another word about it. Several moments later, some minutes later, his commander, Michael Full, pops up and says, Sasha is attaching the dinosaurs now.
Wow.
Insinuating
right.
that it's some kind of a part that they're putting on the space station. Now, later on, when this event debuted on Filer's Files, George Filer's Weekly Files,
right.
the guacamole hit the fan, as it were, and a famous debunker, whose name I will not mention here, came out with an explanation. He said it was a snipping tool that the Russians used, and it had a nickname dinosaurs because of the shape of the head was something like your typical dinosaur. Now, what we have here is a situation of you can't have it both ways. Either it's a part they're attaching, or it's a tool. But in the context of Kolary's words, it doesn't sound like he's discussing either. And the way Moscow gave him this, you know, get back to work. And he says, understood. Okay. Boss.
Right. Let's listen to that right now.
So dinosaurs are needed here. You can't do anything without them. Say it again. I say we need dinosaurs here. Yes, I have them here. These are with me now. Yes, let them be with you. On your side. Valerie Sasha is attaching the dinosaurs now.
Now, that was an interesting, you listen to the vocal inflection there.
Mm-hmm.
He probably wouldn't be using that tone about a pair of snipping shears or whatever.
No. Remember that these gentlemen have trained for these activities for years in advance. There shouldn't be any surprise at all about anything that they're doing or using or attaching. And yet he sounded like, here we go again. They're here. You can't do anything.
Yeah, these guys keep showing up. Right, right.
Now, several months later, some 6 months later, another EVA with a different crew, Gennady Patalka and Michael Fink, were also on EVA. And in this case, it sounds like a choreographed damage control situation because they go out of their way to keep mentioning the dinosaur scissors, the dinosaur scissors. And you were right, we sure needed them. Oh, we're glad we reminded you. Yes, we're using the dinosaur scissors now. Now we're clipping this with the dinosaur scissors. Now we're putting the dinosaur scissors back in their protective case. And they kept emphasizing it as if they were trying to discredit the dinosaurs from 6 months earlier because of all the publicity. So I thought the folks would like to compare Gennady's dinosaurs.
Let's compare the two dinosaurs.
Good news. Copy. And yes, you're right. We need the dinosaur scissors. I'll copy. Yes, copy, Gennady. But you have the dinosaur scissors. Right? Yes, of course. No other way. I have everything. And just as a girl pulled the dinosaur out of the casing. Well, I have cut one of them, the other. Copy. Michael, how is it going? Excellent. Good.
Jeff, you're still doing this, right?
Oh, yeah. Found several events just from the most recent mission in December, but that's another story.
Oh, really? Yeah, you shouldn't tell a guy like me.
Well,
it's another story. Yeah.
I don't have the examples with
Well, that's fine, but give me a little thumbnail on that.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Sure. Been contacted by several people, Flying Saucer Review magazine in England, George Filer, Filer's Files on this one. We have a situation where the space shuttle is passing near midnight again, no sunshine available, over Florida and the Caribbean. And we have three objects, actually four, flying in a loose formation and changing their position relative to each other over several hundred miles. And at the last moment, just off the west coast of Cuba, these three of the four objects appear to dive into the sea and disappear.
Wow.
And what got George's attention on this, and Harry Challenger in Britain, is that they have alternative information that there are reports that there is some kind of a UFO base on the bottom of the ocean in that location.
You know, we've heard reports of that and talked about it before.
Yeah.
Have you drawn any conclusions about subterranean bases? Actually, I guess underwater bases would be a better term.
Well, on that subject, I know as much as the rest
of us.
It's not something I've studied in depth.
Jeff, you've been recording these things all the time, and you just mentioned an example that happened last December. You have something that's fairly recent that we're going to play here.
Oh, yes, STS-115.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Okay, this flight took place last September, and right near the end of the flight, the last couple of days, everything was winding down. Several objects appeared, which dumbfounded NASA. They made a public announcement about this black one that appeared to be a tile that may have peeled loose from the belly of the orbiter. Of course, this is a great concern after what happened to Columbia.
Sure.
So they took a great deal of time and effort to re-examine the underside of the orbiter with the special camera they use. And as they were doing this, an object appears out from space. It actually describes an arc trajectory, comes toward the shuttle, and passes right in front of the nose. And we will hear the pilot of the shuttle informing NASA, among other things, that it's passing off the nose again.
Again.
So this wasn't the first time they'd seen this object. Now, I can tell you from experience, a piece of ice, debris, NASA later said it was a plastic bag. They don't come round again and again. They go by once, and they're never seen again. So your guess is as good as mine, but this one really intrigued me. It was so complicated, I had to divide this event into three separate pages on my website.
And how long is this clip?
It runs about 30 to 40 seconds.
Okay, well, let's listen to it, and then we'll be back to talk about how they can find it on your website.
Just pass off the nose again. Right now it's at about 12:30, and it's passing out in front of the vehicle.
For Tally-ho, can you get a still imagery if you can, and any estimate on size or range?
The instrumentation communications officer here in Mission Control operating the payload bay camera. With reflections in the camera lens as it looks past the Space Shuttle Atlanta.
Digital downlink?
We do see that.
Okay. That's looking out in front of the orbiter.
Okay, we're seeing three or four objects. Can you confirm that it's just the one that's actually moving? The other ones are just reflections?
No, there are three objects. The one you see two rings right there. They're the ones we kind of had the late tally-ho on. The one down the bottom, that was the one we initially saw that appeared to be foil. So we've got like two rings and then the piece of foil. The piece of foil seems to be further in front with the grounding strap on. It seems to be further in front of the other two, and the other two seem to be about the same equidistant from both us and the forward one.
Copy that.
The crew actually commanding this payload bay camera to look at the objects observed out the flight deck windows.
Houston, Atlanta.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how close we are to the trajectory flown by the Soyuz.
And we're asking. We're going to check on that, but while we're waiting for that, we're thinking based on our daylight and KU availability, if we can get back to the OBSS inspection and maybe use the still cameras to photograph these objects.
Yeah, we understand. We're getting back to OBSS.
Thanks.
So on your website, they can find three pages dedicated to that clip.
That's correct.
And,
I have over 200 pages dedicated to NASA UFOs and the cover-up methods they use.
And most of the cover-up methods we've heard, blame it on tools, language problems. What other kind of cover-up methods do they have?
Well, they use what they call a snow mask. It's added to the television signal after it comes down from the satellite.
Oh, when they have the bad connection.
Well, this is routine at night.
Okay.
It's routine at night. I've been following this for 10 years now. But and the dead giveaway is occasionally they either forget to turn it on Or they'll accidentally turn it off in the middle of a video downlink. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, all this nasty snow obscuring the picture, and you're just looking at this as if you got a bad signal on your television, and all of a sudden it snaps off, and you have crystal clear. Or vice versa, they turn on the downlink, you have crystal clear views, and all of a sudden, like flick of a switch, the snow comes on. And NASA uses a little semi-transparent logo in the upper right of their television.
And it's always clear.
No.
Oh,
the
okay.
The snow is over the top.
Well, then that gives away, doesn't it? That gives it away.
Smoking gun on that
okay.
one. Another one that they like to use is what I call the red-green-blue color cycling. Black and white TV, as you know, as a showbiz man, is black and white and gray and nothing else. But NASA oftentimes will do something to their black and white broadcasts where you have these red, green, blue bars going across the screen over, just cycling on and on and on and on. It's really distracting to the eye. And for your average everyday person, a citizen of the United States viewing, they might get real bored and stop watching because of this.
And that's probably the hope. In other words, they got a guy that's in charge of that.
Yeah, and the last one example I have for you is what I call the 20-second delay. You may recall the famous STS-48 footage, what appeared to be some kind of weapon shooting at a UFO over the Pacific. That was in 1991. After that, rumors abounded on the Internet that NASA had instituted an 8 to 10 second delay like is often used in talk radio when you take calls.
Sure, sure.
But it was denied by NASA. They said, nope, we don't do that. It's all live.
It's
you
all
see
live,
it as fast
right,
as we do. But I caught him a couple of years ago during the docking operations of a Russian cargo freighter known as Progress. A Russian ground technician on an open channel complained mildly that NASA was giving them the TV feed on a 20-second delay. And then he said, it's okay, though.
Yeah.
But so that proved it.
Yeah,
and
right.
There's no doubt about it. There is a 20-second delay. And NASA doesn't even give our Russian partners in the space station program.
They don't tell anybody.
In real time.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about some of your projects here. What have you got here that we want to talk about? The website, for sure.
Yeah.
And
the
what
else? The
website
totals 380 pages. 200 of those, roughly, are on the NASA subject, with a few pages on Russian UFOs from Soyuz flight and even a couple from the Chinese space program. Last year, while I was here at this conference, Bob Brown invited me to make a documentary film to enter in the film festival here. Well, I ended up making two. They're in the festival here. They're called What Are They Hiding? What Are They Hiding To? They're being sold by UFO TV worldwide under the title Secret Space, What Is NASA Hiding? Runs about 2.25 hours total runtime. It's been seen by a number of people who are in the know, and they say they thought it was very well done.
And we have a link for that, too, so people can
yes,
order
we do.
It. Is that expensive?
It's $29.95 for the two-disc set.
Well, so that's pretty good.
It's available anywhere. It's going to be at Netflix and Blockbuster soon.
Oh, so if you're coming along. You're coming along with it. What's your next project?
Well, when I get home, we're almost on in time for the launch of STS-117. So when I get home, I'll recover from a week of sitting up in my wheelchair and I'll get started preparing for that flight, and we'll just follow the normal routine. I hope to produce a third movie this year. I have enough material to produce at least six, because the first two movies only cover the one event from last summer and events from 1999-2000.
Jeff, it's been a pleasure. We wish you a lot of luck, and we look forward to checking back with you on all these things.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Jeff.
Okay, thank you. The 60th anniversary Roswell Jerry Pippin Show t-shirt is now on sale. A limited amount of sizes, medium, large, and extra large, are still available. But they are going fast. This t-shirt is made of fine fabric, 100% ultra cotton. and the design of the alien skull will astound you and others around you when you wear this t-shirt for casual wear. Hurry, supply is limited. $15 plus shipping at shopjerrypippin.com.